nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology. You can follow along with this presentation by going to nanohub.org and downloading the corresponding slides. Enjoy the show.
Okay, then let's go ahead and get started. All right, so we're talking about this general model, and there are a couple of more things I want to say about this general model before we start to use it. So what you should remember from the previous lecture is just one key result. We have this very simple model of a device. We're going to use this conceptual model, and we'll even use it in the bulk, and we'll show you how that happens on Friday. But the basic thing, the basic expression that we derived was relatively simple. We just had to do a little bit of bookkeeping and go through step by step. So we got an expression for the current in terms of the difference between the two Fermi levels at the two contacts. And there are these fundamental constants, 2q over h. And then there's a parameter that has units of energy that represents the strength of the connection from the device to the contact. There's a pi, and then there's a density of states divided by 2. And the important thing is current only flows when there's a difference in Fermi levels. Now, it's very important. Don't ask what the Fermi level is in this little device. We never need to know it. It's not well-defined there. There are two well-defined Fermi levels because these contacts are big and they're in equilibrium. The little bit of current that flows just perturbs equilibrium a little bit. Okay, so just a few topics that we're going to discuss today. Modes, transmission, and then say a little bit about it, and then we're off. Okay, so the homework assignment that I ask you to do will give you the answer here. This was the one I posed on Monday. So here's the answer. If you look at this thing, gamma pi d over 2, this is not going to be the most useful way for us to work with it in this class. We could, but we're going to express it in another way that's equivalent. But if you look at that and ask, you know, what are the units? Gamma has units of energy, because it's h bar over tau. And what are the units of h bar?
Joule seconds,
right? Tau is seconds. So it has units of energy. It represents the broadening of the energy levels. Density of states, you know, this has the units per energy. It's the number of states per energy. You know, there's a volume or an area or a length in there depending on whether we're 1D or 2D or 3D, but this is the total number of states. So if I multiply energy by pi by 1 over energy, this is just some number. And we have to figure out what this number means. And we're going to establish that what the number is, it's the number of conducting channels that the electrons can flow in at that energy E. Okay. Now, there are lots of ways that we could do this lecture. And I'm going to try to present it in a way that if you've had 606, it will look plausible to you. We'll revisit some of these later on and do a better job of it. But I'm hoping to make this plausible to you today. So we could work in 1D, 2D, or 3D. So let's just pick 2D. So we can think about maybe this is an inversion layer of a MOSFET. So this is the channel. Electrons can move in two dimensions. So they're moving around at some velocity in the XY plane. So there's some angle theta. The magnitude of that velocity is dependent on their energy. If it's a parabolic band, 1/2 mv squared is equal to the kinetic energy. Okay. And let's see if we can figure out what this product, gamma pi density of states divided by 2, is. So we know the density of states. And remember, when I write it d sub 2d, it means I'm writing the density of states per energy per square centimeter. So the total number of states, and I have to multiply by the area of this 2D plane. And the density of states then is just in 2D, we've seen this, effective mass over pi h bar squared if it's a parabolic band. I'm assuming that the valley degeneracy is 1 here just to keep things simple. If it isn't, I'd have to multiply by whatever it is. Okay, so let's see if we can figure out, first of all, what this gamma is. And that's just another way of asking, what is tau? right? Because we just defined it two different ways. Okay, so here's the experiment. We have these two expressions that we derived on Monday for the current and for the number of electrons in the device. The current depends on F1 minus F2. The number of electrons depends on F1 plus F2. Okay, so if I just take the ratio of Q times N, that's the total amount of charge in the device, and divide it by I, I'll just take the ratio of those two expressions. So that's H bar over gamma, and then the N gives me an F1 plus F2, and the current gives me an F1 minus F2. Okay. So that's a little bit complicated, but I could think of myself as doing a Gedanken experiment. You know that term? It's German, right? It means a thought experiment. You're not ready to do it, but you think about doing an experiment. So the experiment that we're going to do is, let's say we apply a big enough voltage to the second contact. That lowers the Fermi function in the second contact. That means that the probability that this energy state is occupied by electrons coming in from contact two is going to be essentially zero, because the Fermi level is so low. All right, I could go in the lab and I could apply the voltage and make that happen. So we have only injection from one of the contacts. Electrons come in the left contact and they all go out the right contact. Right, that's the experiment. Now it's easy to evaluate this. Q times N is just a stored charge, current, and that's the quantity that I'm after, H bar over gamma, that's tau. So stored charge divided by current is the time. We could have guessed that probably. This is what electrical engineers have been doing for 50 years. This is called a charge control model. The current is charge divided by time. That's all this says, right? Now there's an assumption here that no funny business is happening at the contacts, and I'll show you where that assumption comes in this slide. So this is our definition of this time. We're trying to figure out what this time is. It's just a stored charge divided by the current that's flowing. Okay. So let's think about this device. I have some electron density. It's a uniform device. The electron density is just uniform within the device. I'm not trying to spatially resolve it because I'd need a Boltzmann equation or something to do that. We just have a uniform density. The device has some length, L. And I'm going to assume ballistic transport. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. Remember what capital... Is there a question?
Yeah, I'm just wondering, are we still in near equilibrium transport when we assume that we...
Not really. Well, in this particular case, I'm applying a large voltage to the second contact, but I am not in this... In this particular device structure, I'm going to arrange things such that that potential gets dropped right at the contact, and it doesn't induce a high electric field in here. If it did, it would give the carriers all kinds of energy, and I would be far from equilibrium. So for this particular experiment, when I applied that voltage, it was just to stop the second contact from injecting. All of the additional voltage drop was just dropped here at this end. So the electrons that get injected are thermal equilibrium electrons from the contact. They don't get accelerated, right? It's just that I only have them coming in from one contact. So that's a good question. So then they just come in from one contact. Remember what capital N is. It's the total number of electrons in the device. So that's the electron density per square centimeter times the area of the device. That's the total number, right? Okay, so I multiply that by Q and I've got the numerator. Okay, what's the current? Okay, so we could do this in a number of ways, but you probably remember that current tends to be electron density times velocity, right? It's a flux of particles moving. So if this is the average velocity of electrons moving in the plus x direction, coming in from the left contact, so V sub x plus at energy E average, that's just the average value that they're flowing in the plus x direction. So this is the velocity. This is a number. The current should be proportional to that. I need a Q. And then if you look for your dimensions, you're going to need a W, the width coming out of the page here. This is the length. There's a width of that 2D resistor coming out of the page. So current is basically just charge times velocity. Okay, now I just divide those two. And what you'll get is most everything drops out, and we just get length divided by average velocity. That's just the time it takes electrons to go from one end to the other. Here's where I'm assuming that there's no funny business at the contacts. You know, if it was hard for electrons to get in and out of contacts, that might determine the time. I'm assuming that the time is determined by them flowing through this resistor, and they can just flow out the contact and nothing slows them down. When people work on IV characteristics of molecules and things, they're much more worried about the contact because it doesn't take much time to flow across the molecule. But we're talking about wires and resistors and things that are a little bit longer, and we're assuming we have good contacts. So this characteristic time is just the transit time. Average time it takes electrons to go across the resistor. Right. Okay, but we have to look a little bit more carefully. It's, you know, in 2D it's not quite trivial, because these electrons can move in the XY plane, so they get injected from a thermal equilibrium population of electrons in this contact, they get injected at all kinds of angles into the resistor. And the ones that get injected at a normal angle go across quickest. And the ones that get injected at some theta greater than zero takes them longer to go across. So I have to compute the average time if I'm averaging them all. Okay, so we do that. We just take... I'm assuming that I have an isotropic semiconductor, so that if I'm injecting at some energy E, the magnitude of the velocity is the same in any direction. So that means the effective mass is isotropic. 1/2 mv squared is the kinetic energy. So then if I want to compute the average, I just have to average over cosine theta. Okay. So the ones that get injected from the left contact, you know, only come in with a positive velocity, so theta goes from minus pi over 2 to plus pi over 2. I just average that. The range of angles that they come in with is pi, and we get an average cosine theta of 2 over pi. Okay. All right. We're going to see this several times. You know, in 3D, we'd have to compute the average x-directed velocity in 3D in spherical coordinates. That's the homework assignment. Okay, so our average velocity then in the direction of transport, the direction that current is flowing, is just 2 over pi times the magnitude of the velocity. That's all. Okay, and remember, this is where the parabolic band assumption comes in. The relation between energy and velocity is V equals 1/2 mv squared. All right, if I had a graphene, I would do it differently. I think we'll talk about graphene later. Okay, so now we can go ahead. We know gamma, it's h bar over the time we just figured out. We know the density of states, so we can just go ahead and figure out what this quantity m is and then see if we can make sense out of it. So gamma is h bar over the transit time. So m is h-bar over L times the average velocity. There's a pi, and then there's a density. It's the total density of states. So it's the density of states times W times L divided by 2. That was our definition of M. So you just plug everything in, and let's see what we're going to find. One of those L's drops out. We're left with a W, so M is proportional to W. And actually, you can see this is a very useful answer that we can figure out the number of modes now for almost anything. So this quantity is h over 4, not h bar anymore, average velocity in the direction of transport times the density of states. So that's what it is. We'll see if we can figure out what that means in a minute. In 2D, if we go through this argument, we get a W. In 1D, we wouldn't have had the W. In 3D, we would have electrons flowing through some cross-sectional area. and the number of channels would be proportional to the cross-sectional area. But then we'd have h over 4 average velocity times the 3D density of states. So these are general expressions. If we want to find out for graphene what the number of channels is, we'll use the density of states for graphene, and we'll figure out what this velocity is for graphene. The homework problem, I ask you to do this in 3D. So you'll have to use the density of states in 3D, and you'll have to figure out what the average velocity in the direction of transport is in 3D. All right, crank it out, and you'll get the answer. Okay, but, you know, that'll just be some algebra. Let's see if we can figure out what it means. So we have this expression. It was easy to obtain. And we know what the average velocity in the direction of transport is. And we know how that's related to energy. So I could express that in terms of energy. We know what the 2D density of states is, and this all assumes a parabolic band. So we just plug things in, and this is what we get. So it kind of makes sense that the number of channels is proportional to the valley degeneracy. If I've got two valleys, I'll have channels for each of them. It's proportional to width. The wider it is, the more channels there are to flow in. And it's proportional to this, whatever it is. Okay, so let's look at that a little bit. Square root of E, if I solve this for the wave vector, I can see that the wave vector is going to be proportional to the square root of E minus EC. So it looks like that square root is related to the wave vector K. And in fact, you just solve for K and put it in there, and we'll find that this is valley degeneracy times width times the wave vector of the electrons, 2 pi over lambda divided by pi. So the wavelength is 2 pi over lambda. I'm going to be using lambda for something else, so I'll call this lambda sub b, like the de Broglie wavelength, the wavelength of the electron. So it's w, there's a valley degeneracy that we don't have to worry about. That's intuitive. Width divided by the number of half wavelengths in the conductor. That's what this number m is. Okay, that looks fairly simple. It ought to have some simple interpretation. So let's see if we can figure out, you know, what that is. Here's our resistor. You know, it's got some long length. It has some finite width. Okay. And you can see that if the electron wavelength, if there's one half wavelength that fits in there, I'll get one channel. Now, what does that mean? Well, my electron wave function, remember, I'm going to throw away the block part. There's this rapidly varying part on the scale of the crystal lattice that we don't worry about because this thing is big compared to the scale of the crystal lattice. It has a plane wave. This is e to the I kx times x. That's a plane wave propagating in the x direction. But it's a sine wave in the y direction because the boundary conditions are that the wave function has to go to zero at both sides. Yeah, I've got a finite width to the resistor, so the electrons can't get out. So you can see here that there are some fixed k's that will satisfy those boundary conditions, some integer number of pi over w. Okay. So what this half wavelength says is that, you know, it's the first value here. If a half wavelength fits in here, so what that says is this is the largest ky, that means it's the largest ky gives me the smallest wavelength that will fit in there. It satisfies the boundary conditions at both ends. You know, energy is h bar squared ky squared over 2. Energy in general is h bar squared k squared over 2m. The largest ky is when that angle is pi over 2 and kx is 0. So all of the energy is due to ky. So the energy is h bar squared ky squared over 2m. When that biggest ky corresponds to a half wavelength of width, it satisfies the boundary conditions, and that's the one channel. So that's why this thing M is called modes. This is like an electron waveguide. Now, when you calculate, do waveguides in 604, do you still do waveguides in 604? You impose the boundary conditions, you make the wave go to zero at the boundary of the waveguide. you get modes like, you get confined modes like this. Same thing for the electrons. That's, so M is called a mode for that reason. Now, if you look at, you know, what does it mean when M is equal to 2? So when M is equal to 2, you know, maybe I'm at a higher energy. And now the largest ky, that gives me that, whoops, that energy, h bar squared ky squared over 2m is equal to this higher energy. The largest ky that will fit in would be, correspond to a complete wavelength. Right? So that is the one, again, that's the one where the angle is pi over 2, so kx is equal to 0. So that fits in. Okay, but at the same energy, all right, it's only the magnitude, h bar squared magnitude of k squared over 2m that gives me the energy. So I could have a kx that's finite, and I could have a smaller ky or a bigger wavelength that also satisfies the boundary conditions. So for that energy, I have two modes that satisfy the boundary conditions. Okay, so the physical interpretation of that algebra that we went through is that M corresponds to the number of half wavelengths that fit into the width of the resistor. Each one of them gives us a channel for current to flow. You know, all electrons have to satisfy those boundary conditions, and only a discrete number that meet those conditions satisfy it. So that's what the physical interpretation is. It's, you know, it all comes from these boundary conditions. Okay, so, you know, when we started, you know, we're all familiar with density of states, you know, and we know how they vary in 1D, 2D, and 3D for parabolic bands. They all have different energy dependencies. So now we have this new quantity, M of E, and we're going to need to use both. So we've looked in 2D, and we find that M of E, the density of states, was independent of energy in 2D. But the, I'll call this the distribution of modes. It's how the modes are distributed in energy. It goes as the square root of energy when we went through this algebra. If I were to do this in 1D, we'll talk about this in a minute, we would find that it's independent of energy. The density of states one is 1 over the square root of energy. And if I do it in 3D, which is your homework problem, you'll find that the M in 3D goes linearly with energy. Okay. So we have these two quantities, D of E and M of E, and they all have different, they each have different energy dependencies, and that all depends on what the band structure and what the dimension is. Okay, so the density of states, if we're trying to compute a carrier density, we use the density of states. If we're trying to compute a current density, we're going to use this number of modes or number of channels at energy E. And we have this formula that tells us it's proportional to the average velocity in the direction of transport times the density of states at that energy. And we see that it depends on band structure and dimensionality. Okay, let me pause there, see if... Yes?
What forces M to be an integer?
Those what forces M to be an integer? So it's a good question. So it's those boundary conditions. There are only a finite number of KYs that will give me a node at both ends of that resistor. They have to satisfy, the wave function has to go to zero at both sides of the of that width of that resistor. There's just a finite number that will do that. Now, what we are frequently going to do is we're going to have a relatively wide resistor. Too many to count. Now, in principle, they're countable. But when we compute M at an energy E, we're going to find it's a very big number, and we'll be doing integrals instead of adding them up. If you had a very thin resistor, then you would, then it would be a quantum wire. And there might, you know, there might be 2 or 3 or 5 or 10 of those modes. And then you would just add them up.
So in the last lecture, you had related gamma and tau, the escape rate from the contacts, right? And that escape rate, you said, would be dependent on the interface of the contact and the channel, how well the contact is made.
Mm-hmm.
But in this lecture, we came up with the expression that gamma is h bar over the transit time, which is dependent on the channel.
Right, yeah.
So how do we interpret that?
Yeah, so the question, yeah, so that's a good question. I don't know if it was captured on my mic, but I'm assuming that the tau is related to the transit time and it doesn't depend on the contacts. You know, it's really problem specific, right? If you're looking at, if you want to calculate the IV characteristic of a molecule, then you might want to do that. The transit time would be really short. It would be more likely then that the actual escaping through the contact, that that process is going to be the most important thing. The problems that we're going to deal with, first of all, we tend to have good contacts. And secondly, they tend to be longer than a single molecule. So it's the transit time is what limits you. How fast that all that charge that's in there can move out. And the, we're just assuming that the contacts are good enough that they don't limit you. Right? The electrons are flowing through at some velocity and they don't reach the contact and slow down.
Right? So then, we use L over Vx for tau. So that is not general, you're saying?
No.
So then, that, so whatever interpretation we did for the modes, so that may not, that is not general?
No, and, you know, it's not general. And, of course, I did, I'm assuming a band structure now. I have a wave function that has a K, you know, so I'm assuming a big enough material that I can have a band structure and I can have plane waves. No, the gamma pi d over 2 is pretty general. And gamma may be something that you can determine theoretically or experimentally from an experiment. You always have a density of states, whether you have a band structure or not. You have some energy levels. But in this course, we're really going to focus on semiconductor materials with good contacts. So we're usually going to have a K and a wave vector. And it's not general, no. Yes?
So we have this 2D channel that the electrons are going through, and you average in the directions, the velocity, find the average velocity. So you're ignoring the fact that they're going to hit a wall and then bounce off?
Ah, very good question. Yeah. So the question is, what happens when these electrons hit the boundary and reflect? So if I had a perfect boundary, it probably wouldn't matter. If I had specular reflection, momentum would be conserved. It wouldn't hurt the current. It would just come in, angle of incidence equals angle of reflection, and it wouldn't hinder anything. Real surfaces have lots of roughness. And this is a scattering mechanism that people worry a lot about. You know, how rough is the surface? How can we make the surface smoother? In fact, these days, this is one of the big problems when people are taking graphene and trying to make nano ribbons and pattern it into small strips so that they can get quantum confinement and make a band gap in graphene. Because, you know, we've seen it. We just have these bands that cross and there's no band gap. People would like to induce a band gap so that they can make a good transistor. Then they make the most obvious way is just to etch a very thin strip, impose these boundary conditions on KY that give you a band gap. But the edges are enormously rough. And people get, then you get mobilities that are, I think I just asked this question yesterday at a meeting, at least 10 times smaller than you would get without that. So when you have roughness going on there, that's a scattering mechanism, and that affects the transmission, and that's what we're going to talk about now. Okay, so we know modes. Let's go back here and just remind you. We've been talking about ballistic transport. If an electron shoots in from the contact at a normal incident, it just goes all the way across like a cannonball or something. It might come in at an angle, or like the question here, it might come in and specularly reflect off the boundary. But that doesn't really hurt if there's no roughness. If there's some microscopic roughness there, it could reflect back, and that we would call a scattering event. But this is ballistic transport. Okay. So let's talk about the other extreme. Let's talk about diffusive transport. So in this case, we would say there are a lot of scattering centers there. So there may be defects, ionized impurities, might be phonons, crystal dislocations, all kinds of stuff. So an electron gets injected ballistically and goes a little ways, and then it scatters off of something. And that deflects it by some random angle. And it goes a little while further, and it scatters off something else. And it goes a little while further, and it might hit the boundary. And the boundary might be rough, and it might scatter off, at not specularly, but at some angle. And it just keeps going. And if I apply a positive bias on contact 2, that's lowering the Fermi level there. Or you can think it's a positive charge that's attracting the electrons. So there's slightly more chance that it's going to terminate that random walk by going out contact two. But this average distance between scattering events, which we'll call the mean free path, is very short compared to the length of the resistor. In that limit, we call it diffusive transport. And we want to talk about, you know, what goes on then. So it's a random walk. Some of the electrons might turn around and go back out contact one, and then really nothing happened. The average distance between collisions is the mean free path. We'll have to talk about that a little bit. You know, just like thermal velocity, and there are different ways people define it, there are different ways people define mean free path. We have to be careful about the definition in this course. Diffusive transport just means that the resistor is very long compared to the mean free path. Now, gamma is still H bar over the average transit time, but the average transit time is going to be much longer. It's going to take much longer for electrons to get across, right? Because it's much harder to get across. So the ballistic transit time was pretty short. This velocity was just related to the band structure. 1/2 mv² is equal to energy. We need to figure out what the average velocity is when they're diffusing across. Okay. So here, again, this is something we'll come back and we will do this much better when we talk about scattering. But now I'm going to try to make this plausible to you if you've had 606. So I'm going to assume a channel that's much longer than the mean free path for backscattering, because then I can just assume that carriers diffuse across. So just fix law of diffusion, right? So we'll just do the diffusion part of the drift diffusion equation. That should work, right? And if I can figure out what the answer is there, we'll find out that it works for short ones too. So you might think of this, might look like the base of a bipolar transistor, right? We'd usually call this W, the width of the base. Electrons get injected from one side, they diffuse across. If we apply a large voltage at the collector, everything gets collected and swept out. So the carrier density is near zero at the collector end. It's big at the emitter base junction where you're injecting electrons. You know, in our Gedanken experiment, if we apply a large bias on contact two, but don't let the field inside the region get big, so we just collect everything, then everything will get injected from side one, and we would expect the profile of electrons inside that resistor to look like that. Right? This is what we get from Fick's law. So there's some concentration that gets injected at the beginning from contact one. There's an assumption here that the length is much longer than the mean free path. If everything gets collected as soon as it hits the end of the device and nothing gets sent back in, then the concentration at the end approaches zero. And if I want to know what the current is, it's just a diffusion current. The gradient is delta N of zero divided by the length. Then I have a diffusion coefficient to give me a diffusion current. I have to multiply by a Q. And to get the units right, I always have to multiply by the width coming out of the page. Right? Just Fick's law. Okay, so now I could find this time tau. And I could find the time tau by taking the charge. The charge is just the area under this. So it's 1/2 n/s times L. Just integrate the area under that. That's the total electron density. So 1/2 n/s times L, multiply by charge and multiply by the width coming out of the page. And then the current is just Fick's law. And then the answer is something which may be familiar to you. Do you remember the base transit time of a bipolar transistor? Yes.
Something that is confusing to me, because all this result is derived in 606, but this is what they call the narrow base approximation, where the width of the base is much less than the diffusion length. And here we are assuming kind of the opposite thing. So it's like the profile is linear, but that is the assumption that you get for a narrow base.
Yeah, that's a good question. This is what we do for a narrow base transistor, but we mean something different about that. You know, in 606, the assumption is always, no matter how narrow the base is, it's always many mean free paths long. Now, what they're comparing the width of the base to is a diffusion length. And it's the average distance an electron can go before it recombines with a hole and disappears. So I'm assuming that there's no recombination. You know, in a bipolar transistor, you're injecting these minority carrier electrons into a p-type base, and they see all kinds of holes around, and they can easily recombine. We're assuming that this is like an n-type semiconductor. There are no holes around to recombine with. That means that the flux that gets injected in has to go out because no electrons can disappear. If there was recombination, we'd get one of these exponentials. You know, and I'd have more flux going in than's coming out because some of them are disappearing inside. So long to us means long compared to the mean free path. But when you take 606, everything was long compared to the mean free path. And when you did 606, you found the transit time for a bipolar transistor. It was the width of the base squared divided by 2 times the diffusion length. Right? That's always a nice number to carry around in your head, or a nice equation, because it's the average time it takes for carriers to diffuse across a region. So now we can look at this. In this diffusive limit, remember in the ballistic limit, this parameter gamma was h bar over the ballistic transit time. Now it's h bar over the diffusive transit time. The diffusive transit time we now know. So if I want to find out gamma now under these conditions, I could divide, it should be h bar over tau diffusive, so I could divide by tau ballistic, multiply by tau ballistic, and then keep my tau diffusive there. So h bar over tau ballistic, that's the thing that we called modes in the ballistic case. And all we have is it multiplied by a numerical factor, by a numerical factor that's very small, because it takes a very short time for them to zip across ballistically, but it takes a very long time for them to diffuse across. So that numerical factor we're going to call T, and it's the transmission. And what that means is that these parameters in our model, gamma, pi, density of states divided by 2, now it's just this number T times what we had before. So it means that whereas in the ballistic case, it was just the number of channels at that energy, now it's the number of channels times this numerical factor that's much less than 1. That's all. Because the transit time is much longer. And you can see that if you want to get in the diffusive limit, this parameter T is very small compared to 1. If I let it go to 1, I just get the previous results. So T is something that goes between 0 and 1. Right? If it's 1, we're ballistic. If it's small, we're diffusive. And let's see here. Oh, one further thing. I have to pull something. As I said, I'm trying to make things plausible to you. Let's say one more thing about this. You know, what is this? It's not going to be convenient for us to work at it in this way. But I know what these are. So I could just take the ratio of those two quantities, and then I have to pull something out, which we will derive later. But it's also something we're going to see frequently in this course. What is this diffusion coefficient? Somehow it's related to scattering. Right? The shorter that mean free path was when I did that random walk, if the mean free path is very short, the diffusion coefficient is very small. You know, it's hard to diffuse across. So it's plausible that the diffusion coefficient is proportional to the mean free path. And if you want to get the units right, you have to multiply by a velocity. And the right velocity is the average velocity in the direction of transport, the one we saw before, 2 over pi times v, magnitude of v. But I have to divide it by 2. So you can check that the units are right. It's centimeters squared per second. It's not quite easy to see where the 2 comes in, but we will see that later when we derive it. What that means then is that if I just evaluate that ratio and use this expression for the diffusion coefficient, then if I relate the diffusion coefficient to the mean free path, I get a really simple answer. This parameter T, which we're going to interpret as the transmission. It's the probability that an electron injected from the first contact goes out the second contact. And it's simply the ratio of the mean free path for scattering, the average distance that an electron goes before it scatters off of something, to the length of the region it's trying to get across. In diffusive transport, this is very, very small. Okay. Now, I'm going to try to be careful here. As I said, there are many mean free paths. I'm going to call this a mean free path for backscattering. When we derive it, you'll see a little more why we give it that name. But people, just like people have different ways to define the thermal velocities, they have different ways to define the mean free paths. And we're going to have to be careful that, you know, if we define the mean free path this way, then the diffusion coefficient is this. Sometimes people define the mean free path a little differently. All right, so this is a second concept. It's T. And we showed that if we took a very long one, that T is lambda over L, and it's much less than 1. And we could just look at it and see that if T goes to 1, we get our ballistic limit. If we're in between, we would expect to be somewhere between 0 and 1. And if I just write down this expression, you can see that it goes to the proper limits in both cases. If the length is much longer than a mean free path, it gives me the answer that we derived. If the length is much shorter than a mean free path, it gives me 1, the right thing that has to be in the ballistic limit. Now, the thing that may not be so obvious is that it gives you the right answer in between, too. So we'll derive that later. So now we can derive the resistance and get all the answers in 606. But we can just set T equal 1 and find out what a ballistic, we'll find out if a ballistic resistor has any resistance, right? And if we're in between those two limits, it's no problem. All right, so that's basically it. I think there are just one or two more things I wanted to summarize. So we have these two ways to write the same equation. Most of the time in this course, maybe all of the time for the rest of the course, I don't recall, we're going to express the current as 2q over h times the product of transmission times number of channels times f1 minus f2 integrated over all the channels, over all the energy. That's going to be the most convenient way for us to work. So you can see there are two key parameters. There's some fundamental constants. Now, this is an equation that you want to remember as well as you remember a drift diffusion equation, because this is the starting point for everything we talk about in transport. And there are some fundamental parameters, 2q over h, but then there's an m, and the m, we say the physical interpretation is it's the number of channels at energy E, and we have an expression for that, and we can work it out in 1D, 2D, or 3D, and T is the probability that an electron that comes in the first contact goes out the second contact, and we're just going to use this expression for a few weeks, and we'll see where it comes in about midway through the course. We'll see how you derive it. Now, let's do it in 1D because it's easy to do and it gives us some insight. So here's our expression. And remember, we derived the 1D density of states, and this works no matter what band structure. 2 over pi h bar, 1 over velocity. So if I do that, then all I have to do is multiply by the average velocity in the direction of transport, which was v times 2 over pi, and we can get an expression for m of e, and then I've got an h bar and an h up there, and you go and you simplify everything, and you get m is equal to 1. All right. How do we see that? What does that mean? Let's say this is the e of k in the direction kx that electrons can flow in 1D. Let's say that this is a nanowire where things have been confined, so instead of being at the bottom of the conduction band, the minimum energy is at that first confined subband. Then I have some E of K which goes all across the Brillouin zone. If I look at any energy, there is a state there with a positive velocity that can carry current from left to right. Right? That's a channel. And you can see it doesn't matter if I have an energy down here, M of E is 0. There are no states. Once I get above the bottom of that band, M of E is 1. In fact, if I go all across the band, M of E is just 1. Anywhere I go there, there's one state at that energy that will carry current. If I go above the top of the band, I lose the states again. So M of E you know, would go between 0 and 1, and it would just have this simple shape. Now, there are other subbands, right? We quantum confinement. There's the first state, the second state, the third state. So here's a plot showing the second state, and I'm not going out to the edge of the Brillouin zone where they turn around. But now if I do the same thing, if I'm at an energy below the first subband, there are no states. If I'm an energy above the first subband, there's one state. If I'm at an energy above the second subband, I have two states. So M of E would go 0 when I'm low in energy. When I only have the first subband, it's 1. When I have both subbands, it's 2. People will sometimes call that T bar, the total transmission. So if people talk about a transmission that's bigger than 1, what it means is that it's the total transmission. They're adding up the transmission through all of these independent subbands. Okay. And as I said, I'm going to ask you to work it out in 3D and verify that it goes linearly with energy. Okay, so we have these two different quantities that we're going to use frequently that have different energy dependencies. And I just want to point out that this is something you might have seen before. You know, when you did 606, did you talk about density of states effective mass? Maybe you vaguely remember it. Yeah. So remember, if you compute carrier density, the way you get expressions for the carrier density is you integrate density of states times Fermi function over the conduction band. Right? And you get expressions like this. This is the normalized Fermi energy. This is the effective density of states. If you have a simple parabolic band, this is just the effective mass. If your band structure is more complicated, like silicon, where you have these 6 ellipsoids, then you have to do all your bookkeeping in the 6 ellipsoids. And if you want to make the final answer look like the simple answer, you define some quantity called the density of states effective mass. And it's some combination of the longitudinal and transverse effective masses and the valley degeneracies. Okay. If you're germanium, I think it looks a little different. And, you know, for your specific semiconductor, you have to know something about the band structure in order to do that. Now, if you're calculating mobility, the simplest way to calculate mobility is Q tau over M. You've probably seen that. You know, what M do you use? If it's a simple parabolic band centered at K equals 0, you know, it's just the simple effective mass here and the simple effective mass here. If it's a more complicated band structure, you know, then you've got to be a little more careful about the bookkeeping. Has anybody seen this before? Conductivity effective mass? All right, we'll try to talk about it later on. But you know, you can envision, you have these 6 ellipsoids. Let's say the current is flowing in the x direction. 2 of them have their long longitudinal axes in the x direction, and the other 4 have their short axes in the x direction. So the right effective mass is going to be some combination of the effective masses. That's called the conductivity effective mass. So every semiconductor that has a different band structure, people will talk about the density of states effective mass. They'll use that for finding carrier densities. They'll talk about the conductivity effective mass. They'll use that for the mobility. We're having the same thing here. We have 2 quantities that we need to know from the band structure, the density of states and M. And in order to calculate current and carrier density, we have to use both of them. But it's the same thing you would use in a traditional course. Let me mention, okay, graphene. All right, so we can work it out for anything now. You know, we have this general expression. For graphene, we worked out the density of states. Graphene, we also have to average. It's a 2D conductor. We have to average over angle. We get the same 2 over pi. The difference is it doesn't matter what the energy is. The velocity is always the same in graphene. It's got this linear dispersion. The slope is the same everywhere. So it's even simpler. So now when I multiply velocity times density of states, I'm just multiplying the density of states times a constant. And we get an energy dependence of M that's the same as the energy dependence of D. So, okay. All right. So, you know, we could go back and we could ask, well, what does this mean? It should mean the same thing. So if I take this expression, and if I remember, in graphene, energy is proportional to the magnitude of K. And if I just take that expression, if I look for positive energies and insert that into the numerator of M, Then I can relate M to K, and I get an expression like this. And then I remember, aha, this 2, there was a valley degeneracy of 2 in graphene. That must be what that is. So the bottom line is that this expression here is just the valley degeneracy times the number of half wavelengths that fit into a width of graphene, right? Just like it was for the parabolic band, same physical meaning. And in this case, you know, we saw for a parabolic bands, density states and M have different energy dependencies. Turns out for graphene, they have the same. Right? All right, that's basically it. You know, this is the bottom line equation that we're going to want to spend a lot of time with. There are 2 key parameters there. We know how to evaluate them, and we know what they mean physically. The transmission is related to scattering, and we're going to talk quite a bit more about scattering in the middle of the course. But for now, I'm just going to ask you, if somebody tells you this is the mean free path, then you know how to compute the transmission, and we'll talk about where it comes later. If you're interested and you want to see how you compute M numerically, like say you have a complicated band structure that you only know as a numerical table, you can take a look at this paper that my student Chang Wook wrote, and he tells how you can go about doing that. Okay, are there any questions? Okay, so we'll wrap up a few things. If there's anything unclear, drop me an email, and we'll see if we can talk about it a little more. I think we have plenty of time on Friday, so I'm going to wrap up a few more things and bring in another topic or two, but we'll have plenty of time for questions if you have them. Okay.